नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय इन्द्रो भगवता तत्थं त्रैलोक्या श्रियं ऊर्जितं भुञ्जानपाति लोकं स्त्रीं खामां लोके प्रवर्षति
Indra, King of Heaven, receiving benedictions from the Supreme Personality of Godhead and thus enjoying highly developed opulences, maintains the living entities all over the three worlds by pouring sufficient rain on all the planets.
Gyanam Chanu Yugam Brute Hari Siddha Swarup Drik Rishi Rupa Dhara Karma Yogam Yogesha Rup Drik.
In every yuga, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, assumes the form of Siddhas, such as Sanaka, to preach transcendental knowledge. He assumes the form of great saintly persons such as Yajnavalkya to teach the way of karma. And he assumes the form of great yogis such as Dattatreya to teach the system of mystic yoga. Purport
by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada.
For the benefit of all human society, not only does the Lord assume the form of Manu as an incarnation to rule the universe properly, but he also assumes the forms of a teacher, a yogi, jnani, and so on, for the benefit of human society. The duty of human society, therefore, is to accept the path of action enunciated by the Supreme Lord. In the present age, the sum and substance of all Vedic knowledge is to be found in Bhagavad Gita, which is personally taught by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the same Supreme Godhead, assuming the form of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, expands the teachings of Bhagavad Gita all over the world. In other words, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, is so kind and merciful to human society that he is always anxious to take the fallen souls back home, back to Godhead.
In every yuga, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, assumes the form of siddhas, such as Sanak, to preach transcendental knowledge. He assumes the form of great saintly persons, such as Yajnavalkya, to teach the way of karma. And he assumes the form of great yogis, such as Dattatreya, to teach the system of mystic yoga. Today we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 8, Chapter 14, entitled The System of Universal Management, Text 7 and 8. In the previous chapters, Srimad Bhagavatam explains the story of the churning of the ocean of milk. Therein, the devas, despite their power, fame, and opulence, are put in a situation of terrible suffering that is beyond their control.
Krishna tells in Gita, Abrahma bhuvanaloka punar avatanojana mamupechita konteya punar janmanavijyate.
The nature of this material existence is that suffering is inevitable. Whoever we are, wherever we are, from the highest planet to the lowest, there is this consistency that because everything is temporary, dukalaya mashashvatam, we have to suffer. The cause of the suffering is the very same cause of happiness at root. Anandamayobhyashat. That the Supreme Absolute Truth is the ultimate enjoyer of infinite pleasure. And mamaivam so jiva loke jiva bhutana sanatana. Because we are part and parcel of Krishna, we are satchit ananda. We also exist for the purpose of pleasure. But because the soul is eternal, and the relationship of love between the soul and God is eternal, the pleasure of that relationship is the origin of all pleasure. In fact, it is the only reality of pleasure. The ecstasy of the divine substance of the soul and its culmination is the exchange of love between God and the soul. But in this material creation, forgetting our own spiritual identity, which is eternal and full of knowledge and bliss, forgetting our loving relationship with the Supreme Absolute Truth, we try to find that pleasure through the temporary experiences of the body and the mind. And all these facilities, anything that gives us any level of pleasure, we naturally become attracted to it. To the degree it gives us pleasure, we become practically addicted to it. Why? Because it's connecting us to our original desire of wanting to enjoy a loving relationship with Krishna. Krishna is all attractive. And Krishna tells in Gita, all the attractive, beautiful things of this entire creation are but a spark of his splendor. This material existence is a reflection of our own spiritual reality. The real substance of pleasure cannot really be enjoyed here. Just a reflection. A reflection of a single spark. Can infatuate and obsess not only humans and animals and insects and plants, but even the devatas, the demigods. What to speak of the original source? Whatever pleasures in this world according to the analogy often used, is like a reflection of a single sun ray. Compare that to the quantity of pleasure of the entire sun planet, which includes all sun rays, but not the reflection, the real substance. That is the pleasure of reconnecting with Krishna. It is not that seeking pleasure is something that people just like to do. Because of the nature of the soul, eternally, seeking pleasure is the absolute necessity of existence. And the great tapasis or yogis who give up physical temporary pleasure, they're doing it to experience a higher pleasure. It may be the pleasure of Brahman realization, Paramatma realization, or the full-fledged in all-inclusive realization is that of Bhagavan. But everyone's seeking pleasure. These beautiful stories in the scriptures are so important because we are so much conditioned, habituated to finding alternative pleasures to that of the real soul's love for God. But whoever we are, and whatever we accomplish, because within this worldly existence, everything is temporary and limited, everything ultimately brings suffering. You become attached to something, and you lose it. That's material existence. And then you get attached to something else, and you lose it, and you lose it. Now, some may question, why did God create like this? Where anything you get attached to, you have to lose, and you have to suffer. Why? If we didn't lose these things, the soul would likely just go on trying to enjoy these petty little reflections of tiny little sparks of real substance forever. But the sufferings of this world, however small or great they may be, are ultimately created by material energy for the purpose of waking us up to what we really want, for the purpose of sobering us. Krishna wants to give us the best, but we're so obsessed with taking the worst. So a loving mother and father, will she just let the children carry on taking the worst? Sometimes some suffering is necessary so that we'll take seriously what we really have within us that we've forgotten. When Srila Prabhupada came to the Western world in the early days of our society, he was asked, why have you come? He said, I have come to remind you of what you have forgotten. That we're all eternal souls, full of knowledge and bliss. We all have a relationship with Krishna, and that love for Krishna is within us. We find in these stories of Srimad Bhagavatam, even the demigods, and this story is really, if we take them seriously, which is the intention in which these scriptures are written, that we take them seriously, that it really bursts the bubble of our illusions. We're thinking that by making some excellent material arrangement, we're going to be happy and find security and stability by getting more money, by better health, by more influential people around us, by power, prestige. Well, nobody in this earth planet, however successful, can compare to the demigods. Even the wealthiest, most powerful person in this planet, hardly a single one of them lives to 100 years old. Now, for some little insects, they're born at sunset, and they go through an entire lifespan with children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. They go through their infancy, their babyhood, their childhood, their adolescence, then their middle age, old age, really old age. And by the time of the sun rays, for those who survive, they die of really old age. Yes? Now, for those little insects, because many of them don't live till the sunrise, they really consider what an expansive, fantastic life. He lived till the sun rises. What is compared to demigods, for us to live 100 years is not even that. Our 6 months is hardly one day for the demigods. Yes? They live extremely long lives. Up to Lord Brahma, who lives over 311 trillion years. Same body. So these demigods, they have long lives and they have great power and they're always in good health. We never read in the scriptures about a demigod with cancer or hepatitis, getting strokes or heart attacks. Doesn't exist. Those things are just for little earth people. Demigods, they don't have. They don't even go old, really. When their karma runs out, they just have to leave their bodies and leave everything behind. They don't have to go through all this old age stuff like we do, not the same. It's like more like a shift of posts. They're just transferred out according to their karmas to the next place. And here we find the demigods, because the nature of this world is everyone is looking for pleasure, and the soul has an unlimited capacity to enjoy pleasure, because its capacity is in Krishna, who's unlimited. And right in the middle of everything, at the peak of their lives, when everything's so good, there are other people who want what we have. It's the nature of material existence. Wherever you go, envy. Essentially, we come to this world because we want to be enjoyers. But factually, our constitutional position is Jivara Swarupoi Krishnera Nityadas. We're eternal servants of Krishna. Bhoktaram Yagyatapasam Sarva Lokameshwaram suhridam sarvabhutanam gyatvamam shanti mrichchati. Just to understand this truth will bring about real peace forever. Krishna is the real proprietor of everything. He's the real enjoyer of everything. And he's the real best friend of every living being. But we want to be proprietor. We want to be enjoyer. And we want to consider that I am the beneficiary of others. By my goodness, other people are being maintained. Or by my badness, other people suffer. We want to control. This is material illusion. But because everybody essentially has, when we come to this conditioned state, it is due to the root cause of being envious of God's position. And in that state, we are potentially envious of everyone and anyone who impedes the progress of what I want. If someone has more than me, or someone has something that I want, our tendency is envy. And because of that ego, I'm the enjoyer, and the envy that comes from it, there's so much conflict, so much war, so much disunity, disparity between people. If we look at the animal kingdom, on one level, it's very beautiful to see what's happening. You know, the birds are singing and flying. Now, we're enjoying seeing the birds singing and flying, but the worm is not enjoying seeing the bird because this bird is singing and flying, looking to eat the worm. Yes? Little insects are being eaten by the birds. And the insects are eating littler insects. Just an airport, and one company is talking about saving the tigers. There's only, I think, 1,411 tigers left in India. It's very good. I mean, as far as trying to save the tigers, they're people, beautiful species. But the deers, they would be in ecstasy if the tigers were forever extinct from the world, right? Because tigers eat deers. They eat their children, they eat their wives, their husbands, and at any minute they may eat them. So everything is so relevant, relative. But jiva jiva sajivanam. The one living being is eating another living being for survival. Isn't that something to think about? Why the world was made like this, where we have to eat each other just to live? Yes? The spiritual world, when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in Jharkhanda, he was showing what spiritual life is like. You do not have to eat each other. God provides everything plentifully, beautifully, wonderfully. And everything's eternal. There's no death. But this world, death is imminent everywhere. So these tigers and the deers, they are worst of enemies. Tiger only thinks of deers in terms of eating them. They don't think about, oh, such nice, sparkling eyes. And the way they jump is so graceful. Yes, when we see a deer jumping, we think, oh, what a beautiful work of art. How graceful they're jumping, and how beautiful their eyes are sparkling, and how nice. The psychology of a tiger, when they think of deer, it's only one thing. Taste.
what they taste like.
Not only the taste of their blood, but also, you know, how that will diminish the pain of hunger in their stomachs. And the deers, when they think of tigers, they don't think, oh, such beautiful stripes, and so heroic, and so fearless. And the deers don't think, let's name our team after the tigers. To show people how strong and ferocious we can be. It's the king of the jungle. When they think of the tiger, they're stricken with fear and hatred. This is the being that has killed my relatives, and this is the being that at any moment is going to kill me. So what is the relationship between tiger and deer? Fear, exploitation, hatred. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told the tigers to chant Hare Krishna. Then he told the deers to chant Hare Krishna. And they were all dancing and chanting along with Lord Chaitanya. And during the kirtan, it was so ecstatic that the tigers and the deers, they gathered in the same place. And amazingly, the tigers were no longer looking at the deers as food. And the deers were no longer looking at the tigers as death personified. They were seeing each other's eternal souls. The holy name of Krishna helps us to see the spiritual essence in each other and how Krishna is the connecting force between us. And bhakti, or devotion, is our relationship with Krishna, with each other. The tigers and deers began to embrace each other. And not in a romantic way, but in a very spiritual way. They kissed each other. Hare Krishna. In ecstatic spiritual love. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was looking at them thinking, this is just like Vrindavan. This is eternally what happens in the spiritual world. All living beings, they love each other. Because everyone is self-sufficient. No one's in need of anything. Everyone is simply giving, giving, giving their heart's loves to each other, to Krishna. So that is the spiritual world. But the material world is created in such a way that for my survival, I have to exploit something or someone else. And human existence is to minimize as far as possible in a spirit of service rather than exploitation. We also need to eat in this material existence. But fresh vegetables and fruits and other such natural, where we inflict minimal violence and pain on other living beings. And then where that food and the mode of goodness is, where there is minimal violence and pain, when we offer it with love and devotion to Krishna, we're actually helping to liberate the souls of those vegetables and grains and fruits. It's not an act of exploitation. It's an act of loving service. So demigods, in previous chapters of Bhagavat, we find they lose everything. And it happens from time to time. In fact, the Puranas, the Srimad Bhagavatam, especially select those historical moments where the demigods lose everything. There's not many interesting stories about when they're just enjoying life as usual, right? Because there's not much lesson in that. But what they do when they lose everything, that's where the lesson is. They realize, I'm helpless. I need the help of God, of Vishnu. And in every step, Krishna's there to reciprocate. If we turn to him with sincerity, with the sense of real urgency. In this particular verse that we're reading today, we find how, and Srila Prabhupada writes in purport, for the benefit of all human society, not only does the Lord assume the form of Manu as an incarnation to rule the universe properly, but he also assumes the form of a teacher, yogi, jnani, and so on, for the benefit of human society. Nigama kalpataroa galitam palam, that the Vedic literatures are like a desire tree. According to one's inclination, according to one's aspiration, according to one's level of consciousness, one can take to a path that will bring us to the ultimate goal. Or one can take, the Vedas also provide paths that regulate our life either slightly or greatly, give us a higher realization of happiness within material existence, try to bring us from ignorance to passion to goodness, eventually to bring us to the point of surrendering to the Lord. Therefore, there are many forms of dharma taught by different sages, yogis, jnanis. And essentially, in their pure forms, they are all presented by the Lord to elevate human society. You know, some people's conception of God, either you accept, you know, you accept this or you're going to hell forever. But God is so merciful. In the Vedic tradition, we learn that it comes in so many ways. And even if you're not willing to take to spiritual life, he's presenting higher material alternatives so that you can become less implicated in karma. And eventually, you can become a little more pious. And that will bring one to associating with higher and higher types of people. And eventually, you're on the path, maybe a very slow path. Tribadam, what is that? Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nistrigunya Bhavarjana. Krishna tells in Gita that the Vedas mainly deal with the three modes of material nature. The Vedas mainly teach us how to live a more noble and proper life and enjoy more pious pleasures within the modes of material nature. But then Krishna tells Arjuna and tells the world, go beyond all these modes of nature. Go beyond the flowery words of the Vedas. These dharmas are all meant for the purpose of either rapidly or gradually bringing us to Sanatana Dharma. Sarva dharman parityajya. Mamekam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papi pyo moksha ishami masuja. Abandon all varieties of dharma or religious thought and action and just surrender to me. I shall deliver you from all sinful reactions. Do not fear. This is Krishna's promise. And Krishna tells in Gita
that people who are performing these lower types of dharmas, we should not unsettle their minds. We should invite them, try to inspire them to reach the conclusion, which anyone can do at any time in this age, by just surrendering to God, not as the enjoyer, but as the servant. Most religious thought is about trying to dovetail our enjoying propensity so that we enjoy a little more piously. So that we learn to enjoy charity more than just accumulation. So that we learn to enjoy helping others rather than just being selfish about our own needs. It's a higher pleasure. And it brings us closer and it makes us more inclined towards Sanatana Dharma, which is to give up all selfishness altogether and not only help people on the platform of their bodies and their minds, but helping to deliver their souls. Because when we're on the bodily platform of life, real service to others is serving what we identify with, their bodily needs. Yes, that is philanthropy, altruism. Helping the bodily and mental needs of others, which is religious life. Otherwise, we don't care about others. We care about me. We care about I and mine. But through this type of developing a service attitude on the material platform, we gradually become receptive. That's the whole purpose of piety and philanthropy, is it helps us to come to the mode of goodness and become more receptive to understand our own spiritual identity and the spiritual identity of others. And we want to uplift their souls, not just by giving some temporary relief, but by helping to be instruments of compassion to give people an eternal liberated state of ecstatic devotion. Para upakar. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, it is the supreme welfare work, the greatest of all types of charity, is to awaken another person's eternal soul. Sarva dharma parityasya mamekam sharanam praja. So the devas, they get naturally implicated and distracted by their power, their prestige, and the incredible opportunities for enjoyment they have. So the Srimad Bhagavatam doesn't give too much time talking about how they're enjoying those things in the service of God. They're all doing seva to the Lord. This particular chapter explains that the Lord's agents, the manus, the Lord's agents, his incarnations, his empowered people, they're the ones that give this service to the devas. Imagine Indra. What a powerful position he has. A father, mother takes certain satisfaction and pride in sustaining their family. If not for me, these people would have nothing. They would suffer. They would die. These children would be lost. They'd be on the streets. But because of me, so many opportunities, so much happiness can be provided. Now, just try to think about Indra's position. He provides the rain, according to this verse we're reading today, to all the planets in the universe, from Swarga Loka down. And
Krishna tells in Gita, all living beings subsist on food, and food is born due to rains. Without rain, everyone dies. Yes? During the monsoons, we think, oh, what an inconvenience, so much rain. But what would be the inconvenience if there wasn't monsoons? Again, it's the way Krishna arranges things. Everything is very instructive. Tapasya, tapo divyam putra kayena satvam. Tapasya means to accept an inconvenience for a higher purpose. That's what material life is about. Nobody really likes when it rains. It's muddy, you can't go out, you can't do so many things. Last year we had a big pandal set up in, in November, and massive rains came and the pandal started breaking and water started flowing and the whole area was mud and people were afraid we shouldn't take anyone there because if, you know, there's thousands of liters of water stored on the top of the pandal and if it breaks it could kill people. Yes, be a very intense abhishek. So we're thinking, why rain? Stop the rain. People were praying for the rain to stop, yes? But factually, this is tapasya. Everything is ultimately nourished through tapasya. Our spiritual lives are nourished by taking some inconvenience for a higher purpose. And we can only survive by tolerating inconvenience. Rain is an inconvenience. But without it, we suffer and we die. Now Indra, he's in charge of the rain for all the planets. So can you imagine what kind of father, mother, we are all his dependents. The type of satisfaction that gives him, that everyone is depending on what I provide for them. All life, every species, even the camels can't last long. Even the cactus cannot last long. Ultimately without water. We all need. And he's providing. But even he and all the other devas, when they become too much proud, the tendency is they make offenses, aparads, mistakes, and then there's karmic reactions, and it's beyond their control. And in that state, urgently, with all our hearts, minds, and souls, they turn to Vishnu. Save us. And then, you know, all their piety and all of their everything else they do to maintain their positions is no longer relevant. They surrender. So Krishna is so kind that he comes to this world to teach all different levels of self-realization. He empowers different people for different purposes. All ultimately meant to bring them. Vedaishta sarveraham eva vedyo. The Vedas describe so many different paths to bring people to different levels of consciousness, mainly just a better material state of consciousness. But it's all for the purpose of ultimately knowing Krishna and loving Krishna. And we find this in every religion. The vast majority of all followers, they interpret their particular scripture or their particular teacher in such a way to just live a a little better, more comfortable, materialistic life. And hopefully, you know, after death, there may be some other heaven that I can go. But the true saints of all spiritual paths are teaching Sarva Dharman Parityasya. You have to be a completely selfless servant, lover of God, to actually achieve the transcendental pleasure of bhakti, of prema. And Srila Prabhupada explains that Krishna explains all of these different levels of consciousness in a very summarized, concise way in Bhagavad Gita. And ultimately comes to the conclusion. Man manabhava mad bhakto mad yajim nam namaskuru. Worship me, become my devotee. Offer your homage to me. Always think of me. This way you will come to me without fail. It's the conclusion. And then Krishna comes in this age of Kali as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to teach us how to reach the ultimate conclusion of the Gita and beyond in such a simple, powerful way that anyone and everyone could follow. His message, he cites the Srimad Bhagavatam, Kaleru dosandide raja nasti he kumahanguna kirtanad eva krishnasya mukta sangha parambraje. This age of Kali is an ocean of faults. Not a puddle, not a river, not a lake, an ocean of faults. In fact, all the rivers are heading toward the ocean. Practically everything in Kali Yuga is just in the direction of this ocean of faults. But there is a benediction. And this one benediction makes the age of Kali the most worshipable of all times. How is that? Srila Prabhupada explains, Satya Yuga is a time when 100% of the people are following genuine religious principles. And as Satya Yuga progresses, it slightly declines. And by the time Treta Yuga comes, 3/4 of the population are sincerely turning to God and living by Krishna's directions for a happy, prosperous life in this world and beyond spiritual liberation. By the end of the Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, where about half the people are following, that gradually declines, and in Kali Yuga, hardly a quarter of the people are following any real spiritual principles. And by the end of Kali Yuga, practically no one. And the condition of the environment, the world around us, is very much connected to how people are living pious, spiritual-based lives. We read in Satya Yuga how the weather, the duration of life, every situation, prosperity. There was no poverty in Satya Yuga because there was no greed. And Mother Earth was providing everything with abundance because there was yajna. There was reciprocation with Mother Earth. Srila Prabhupada points out, we're only 5,000 years into Kali Yuga, and look what's happening. slaughterhouses, abortions, crime, prostitution, divorce, plundering the earth, so much pollution in the rivers, in the oceans, in the air. Dangerous pollution. Thousands of times beyond what's safe for a human being, most of the rivers in India are that polluted. And wars and karmic reactions of earthquakes and floods and droughts. And we're only 5,000 years out of over 400, and there's what, 432,000 more. Hare Krishna. So why? Why Bhagavatam tells us that the great sages worship Kali Yuga is the best of ages? When even in the beginning stages, things are so chaotic. So much depression, so much anxiety, so much fear. People accumulating these massive bombs and terrorists. Can you imagine what it's going to be like when this accelerates another 400,000 years? Would you like to be here? Anybody who has the slightest bit of piety is going to have to be practically living in the jungles and caves, hiding from the common people who are just exploiting. People be eating each other because there's no food. But in this age of Kali, it's considered the best of all ages because of this one benediction. Despite all faults, anyone who sincerely takes shelter of the name of the Lord, Krishna, can attain the supreme perfection of liberation. And even the problems of Kali Yuga are favorable. Because as we see all these things happening, if we have some good intelligence, we're not just going to chant as a ritual, as a pious religious activity. We're going to see the necessity. We're going to feel a certain type of desperation, not only for ourselves, but for our loved ones and for the world around us. When devotees, even if we're having a happy and nice life, when we see all the conflict and war and suffering of so many people in so many parts of the world, we feel a need, a desperation to help them. And devotees come together like we are today. And we want to not only get shelter ourselves and give shelter to all of our brothers and sisters among the devotee community, but we want to help give shelter to the whole world. We see the suffering. And therefore, when we perform kirtan, it's not just to have some fun. That's there. You'll have fun. But even if you don't, we're crying out the holy names together to help each other and to help the world, to invoke the mercy of God, of Krishna. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught us to raise our arms very high. It says, when you raise your arms high like this, then the potency of the holy names is, you are spreading it throughout the entire universe. It's like you put up your antennas. And it's not just your arms that the antennas, it's your intent. You raise your arms with the intent of spreading the glories of the holy name throughout the entire universe, spreading the blessings of God to the suffering souls everywhere. In this way, Mahaprabhu taught. We raise our arms, taking shelter and giving shelter. And loudly crying out, like someone with great hunger crying for food, like a baby crying for its mother, like a little bird crying for its mother bird, all alone in the nest. The age of Kali not only gives the highest benediction that Krishna comes in his name so accessible, but also gives us an environment where we could really take shelter. This is how we chant the holy name. That was very nice. Srila Prabhupada ends his purport by saying that that Lord Hari is so kind and merciful to human society that he is always anxious to take the fallen souls back home, back to Godhead. And see all the different layers of mercy that Krishna bestows upon human society in all different countries and all different races and all different times and all different ways, just to try to elevate us. Just to try to eventually bring us all back home, back to Godhead. Never interfering with our free will. Some people say, if God is the supreme controller, why does he make this material world with so many problems and pains? Krishna created the material world in such a way, in Satyayuga it wasn't like this because we were good. But in this Kali Yuga, we create the problems and pains. But Krishna's so good, no matter what, no matter when, he's always coming and sending his servants to call us back. Always anxious for us to find the real happiness that is our inherited right. And as Krishna's devotees, we not only want to 100% accept this mercy by our humble surrender, but we want to share it with everyone by loudly, together, chanting the holy name. Is there any questions? Yes, Guru Hari Prabhu.
Hey Krishna. Maharaj, thank you for a wonderful class. Maharaj, you so beautifully described the importance of taking shelter and being helplessly crying out the holy name. But personally, I feel it, I mean, after repeated hearing, it's not possible unless I understand my completely insignificant position. You beautifully described about Indra, and we keep hearing again and again about how demigods are put into very difficult, helpless situations. But having the extra privilege of being born in Kali Yuga, which is a very degree, I meant it very sarcastically, we are actually in a very difficult position. I'm personally in a very difficult position. I've taken this human body, material body, which is a complete disqualification in one sense because I've been envious of Krishna. But despite all this, repeatedly hearing, intellectually trying to understand insignificant position, again and again the false ego, which is like a dog's tail, keeps impressing upon the mind that indeed you're significant. It keeps reminding you of some good thing you've done, some service you've done, and this happens all the time. And we are not able to take shelter of the holy name. We are not really able to appreciate devotees without motivation. We are not able to render service to others because there is motivation, and I don't understand my insignificant, I don't accept my insignificant position. So how do I accept my insignificant position?
Gaur Hari Prabhu. Probably the closest thing to being an Indra is to be a professor at IIT. Topmost scholarly students in the entire country, the cream, the essence of all students, they are under your command. You have the power to fail them or pass them, teach them. Yes? Ready? Nice position. And like Indra, you are doing it in the service of Krishna. But we learn our lessons from Krishna, teaches through his great devotee so many things. Through Indra, he teaches what we have to watch out for. Through Prahlad and other such great devotees, Ambarish, he teaches us how to deal with different situations and turn to him with humility and devotion. But actually, Gaur Hari, we are very, just the fact that you are asking these questions with such sincerity means you really are seeking the essence. You really want to be a humble servant of the servant of the servant. And the process of achieving what you are aspiring for is just that, to want it more than anything else. And that desire comes by hearing about people who have that. Srimad Bhagavatam is the crest jewel of all Vedic literatures, because it gives the most powerful warnings and it gives the most powerful process by which we can overcome all obstacles. And it's all aimed at pure unalloyed devotional service. Nastaprayeshyapadreshu nityam bhagavati sevaya. So by hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam and by associating with devotees who are trying to live by the principles of the Bhagavatam, it clarifies everything very, very nicely for us. The inevitable diversions and illusions that come into our life, when we associate with the people Bhagavatam, when we hear from the book Bhagavat, it makes things very clear. What are the impediments and what is the path to our real aspiration? So that association and reading Srimad Bhagavatam and hearing Bhagavatam will keep our desires and our aspirations very pure. So we're yearning and longing for that. We may have prestige, or we may not have prestige. We may have wealth, we may not have wealth. Doesn't really matter. What matters is in whatever situation we're in, whether we're King Prataparudra or Kulavecha Sridhar, we're aspiring for the true wealth of Prema Bhakti. We're aspiring for the true wealth of service to God and service to the Vaishnavas. And service to all beings. That's our motivation. And these values are established and preserved by hearing. Hearing from the people Bhagavats and hearing from the book Bhagavat. and what the book Bhagavatam and the people Bhagavatam is saying. First, it's helping us to aspire for the right thing, for the highest thing, for the purest thing, pure devotional service. And it's teaching us in whatever situation we're in, whether we're professors or students, whether we are of any particular material situation, we can all attain perfection if we aspire to be the servant of the servant of the servant, and in this spirit to take shelter of the holy name. Essence, the fact that you ask this question, the way you ask this question, is the very answer to your question for all of us. Yes, Prajabihari.
Maharaj, thank you for the class. You mentioned a very important point about Kali Yuga. You said it's not a puddle of faults or not a small lake, it's an ocean of faults. There are so many faults. So I wanted to know about one particular quality, whether it is a fault and how should we address this. And that is when we see diplomatic behavior. Like in the book, you know, Journey Home, you are talking about this incident at Bhavan Maharaj Ashram, where you and your friend David and, you know, that devotee, Jagannath Prabhu, he tells you that if you're a devotee of Krishna, you should not be like this. So that is very instructive. At the same time, we see that we have an institutional structure and a lot of things have to be done, a lot of projects are there. So sometimes to get things done and for expediency, we may have to be diplomatic and not really speak the truth. We may adjust the truth, but in the process, we may hurt devotees. So I wanted to know, how do we balance this diplomacy, first of all? And secondly, if you're on the receiving end, if we know that somebody has behaved diplomatically with us, should we address it with that person, very having an open communication, or should we quietly tolerate, or how should we take it? So basically, I had two questions. One is diplomacy allowed? Is okay with devotee amongst devotees? And secondly, how should we receive it when we see that somebody is behaving diplomatically with us?
Our intention is what is of greatest importance. We shouldn't lie in the name of diplomacy. We shouldn't cheat in the name of diplomacy. We should be in a spirit of servitude. If we act, as you say, in a diplomatic way to achieve some selfish result for ourselves, then that is very unfavorable for Krishna consciousness. However, if we're without selfishness, really trying to serve and help others and sustain our own spiritual lives so that we can qualitatively help others, then it may be very favorable for devotional service. Srila Prabhupada uses the example that a child does not want to take medicine, so the parent puts the medicine in a laddu and says, "Eat this laddu." And the child says, "Is there medicine in it?" And the parent says, "No, there's not. Eat it." Now, that's diplomacy. But she's not trying to exploit the child. She's trying to save the child's life. So it's favorable because it helps to save the child's life. It's higher than her being honest and saying, "Yes, the medicine's in it," and then he doesn't eat it. So diplomacy when it is used as a means to actually offer respect to others and to serve others, then it's favorable. But when it's for our own selfish or egoistic reasons, then it's very unfavorable. So we have to be very careful to calculate our own intent and whether it's actually genuinely necessary. Does that answer your question?
The first part, it actually is addressed very nicely. And the second part, that doubt still remains. Like if, for example, we are on the receiving end of some diplomatic behavior which may apparently seem to us is not in Krishna's interest, like somebody has lied about us to someone and, you know, something like that. And then how should we take it? Should we have an open communication, confront that devotee in a nice way and tell him that we don't like it or it's not correct? Or should we quietly tolerate it and know that it's Krishna's arrangement for our purification?
You can do both. Internally, you can feel that, yes, this is for my own internal purification. But externally, it is not that we can clarify the truth, because it will help us in our service and our capacity to serve others. Does that answer your question? Adibo. Yes, one more question.
Maharaj, you are talking about pure devotional service. If you wanted to attain a pure devotional service, a devotee should have a quality of compassion, forgiveness, humility. If you can attain that, then pure devotional service becomes very easy. But sometimes in our scriptures, we see the example. For example, an example of Bhima. Now, if we see to it the Bhima's example, we could not see that he was having so much attitude of humility, compassion, forgiveness. Those qualities, we couldn't see him. Yet, he could get pure devotional service. So sometimes we have a fear in our heart that whenever we hear all these things, we are not able to adjust with this type of a quality in our heart. And then we take an example of Bhima, that he could get it. So can you just give us that, what is the quality that is required in addition, or if we don't have those qualities also, then also we will be able to get pure devotional service the way Bhima could get it.
Bhima had all those qualities. But he expressed those qualities according to his particular service to Krishna. He was a kshatriya. He didn't work as a consultant of the stock exchange. Like Ananda Vrindavan Prabhu. So, as a kshatriya, and most of Mahabharata is situations where Bhima is either being exploited or on the battlefield. So his humility, he had to fight, and he had to fight courageously with his club. Yes, and he did. He was fighting for Dharma. He's fighting for the protection of the innocent, protection of the sanctity of the world. As a kshatriya, that was his prescribed duty, and that's what Krishna wanted him to do. But he was realized that ultimately everything is coming by the power of Krishna. He understood that Krishna is giving me whatever power and I'm using it for his service. And as far as forgiveness, if he would have forgiven Duryodhana, then the world would have been cast in adharma, and Krishna's will would have been impossible. Yes? He was an instrument of doing what Krishna wanted him to do according to his nature as a kshatriya, according to his prescribed duty. So if we understand the Mahabharata from the perspective of Srimad Bhagavatam, we can understand that Bhima actually had all those qualities, but he had them in the very unique form of a kshatriya. Now, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, those who are on this path should not eat too much or too little. So you may ask, well, how did Bhima follow that? He was brikodar, which means his belly was hungry like a wolf. When the Pandavas would beg, when they were living in the forest, they would divide it. Bhima would take half, and Yudhisthira, Arjuna, Nakula, Sahadev, Draupadi, when Kunti was there, they took the other half. So one may ask, how is this controlling the senses? He did, because that's how much he needed. He didn't overeat. He didn't overeat. That's just how much he needed. That was his particular physical composition. He needed that much. We never see Bhima, you know, going to some Ayurvedic doctor for digestion. He could digest fully. And every bit of that energy that came from the massive quantities of food he ate, he would engage in massive quantities of service. Yes. Prabhupada said about Bhima, he said, you can eat like Bhima if you can serve like Bhima. Yes, otherwise you cannot imitate. So we have to understand the internal significance of Bhima through the Bhagavatam. All those qualities we're speaking about, they were there. But Krishna was using him in a very, very important and special way. And in India, among the children, who's the favorite person of Mahabharata? Bhima. It's very attractive. Ramayana, it's Hanuman. Mahabharata, it's Bhima. And are actually both avatars of Vayu. They're essentially the same personality. Hanuman, Bhima, they're brothers of the same tattva. Bhima had the spirit of Hanuman. According to time, place, and circumstance, he was expressing it. Does that answer your question? Hare Krishna. You know, to be a kshatriya and to fight those wars the way Bhima did, a certain disposition was required. But he did it exclusively for the pleasure and the service of Krishna. When the leader of the Indian National Army approached Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and said, we need people to fight against the British. And you're taking so many of the best, most intelligent men and making them brahmacharis and sannyasis. We need them for the service of our country. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, these are skinny men. They will not be of much help to you. Let them just eat some prasad and preach Krishna consciousness. And he convinced, yes, these are not people meant for the army. But Krishna recruited Bhima and empowered Bhima. And we bow at his lotus feet. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Thank you very much.